So, you hear me okay? Ken? So tonight I want to give a talk with the shortest title of any talk I ever gave. And the title is, It's All Right. All Right. Kol Nachon. And a little bit I want to explore how it all works, the issue of joy and the practice, and how put it in a little bit of a traditional framework also of Buddha Dharma. And all of this is in a framework of non-technical practice. So I know that we have a tendency, all of us, including myself, to say, well, what is it that I really actually need to do now? What is the exact object of meditation and where? But that's the misgerit, because we're in a meditation retreat. But the Dharma is much, much bigger than that. It took 10,000 traditional suttas. And why do you need 10,000? Because the teaching is so vast. So I'm not going to try and do 10,000. But try and put it all in a bit more of a framework so it's you can understand a certain paradox here, which is, we're talking about meditation on what is, and at the same time we are encouraging a quality called joy or happiness, which is something on top of that to grasp. Or I want happiness, I want joy. And how does that fit with just being here with what is and so on? There's quite a few paradoxes in all of this. So I'm going to try and put it all together, or try. So, in the groups and in our own life, we are really, we just want things to quieten down. We just want to get quiet. And quiet includes not only just random noise, as if there's a TV going in our head of all the voices that we've picked up on our journey through life, but also the, you know, quietness from the disturbance, quietness from pain and suffering, quietness from what upsets us. And and quite rightly understand a meditation retreat as quietening down. We give in our telephones, so we quieten externally. We quieten the input. We're not having TVs and stuff here. We're trying to minimize the stuff coming in. And then from the inside, we're trying to kind of connect with samadhi, which is to collect ourselves, to quieten down the chaotic mind, a little bit to tie it down. And it's right. Samadhi is a huge power. And we do develop that way, the power of mind, to be able to really hold in attention and stay there and be in that this moment fully. It's samadhi. It's staying with what is and holding on to it, and it does create power of mind. I was talking last night about it with the staff. We have meetings every evening, and I was talking about one of the signs of meditation is that the brain, it's not just that there's a brain wave called meditation wave, beta wave, it's actually the brain becomes more coherent, that it becomes more balanced. There's not just one thing there and one thing there, but there's something, in English you call it coherence, which I understood is coherentiut, but that may be wrong. Which is, it means the brain has more power. We're looking at now at more than 90% of the iceberg, the karchon, that is under the water. That we live in the 10%, but meditation can bring us down to the 90%. What's really going on in the whole mind? When we look at a flower, really we concentrate, go right inside it. We see so much more, and that's the 90%. Or if we look at a feeling or a breath, instead of this minimal or zero interest in breathing, which is we do 50,000 times a day, we're actually opening the invisible. So samadhi does really open worlds for us, and we can kind of develop a mind a bit like a laser that really sort of cut the bullshit, gets right there to where we are. Directing it, cuts through the confusion and cuts through the conditioning. But there's something in the tradition that also says, what is it that helps samadhi? And here we begin to open the door to qualities of being that help spiritual practice. And one of the interesting things that happen, if you kind of open texts in the traditional Buddhist texts and you ask, so what is the ladder, the step-by-step, the sulam, the ladder that the Buddha gave to beginners who came to him and sat down? And he would say, there's a few different ones, but he would often say, you listen to Dharma talks, you hang around with us, you listen to the Dharma, and what happens then is that you begin to feel a kind of a wow. You begin to feel a joy from a deep, authentic spiritual teaching, which in tradition is called pamoji. In English, you translate it as gladness. So it's not one of another one of these words of joy, happiness, da da da. But gladness. I'm glad that exists this teaching, and I'm inspired by it. That's enough. And the Buddha said, when you experience gladness at listening to spiritual teachings, then your concentration begins to be much easier. And so he often said, first listen to Dharma, first think about it, first read books, talking about now, first listen to Dharma, first open the mind to other ways of looking at things, feel the joy of an authentic teaching, and then go to meditation. We tend to do the opposite. We tend to go to meditation first, and then hope brings joy. There is another opposite way. And there's something quite understandable about that. So I brought up my children. By the way, this talk is going to be full of personal stories. Okay, I'm just telling you in advance. Be warned. A health warning. But I brought up my children in nature. We lived 5 years without any electricity at all. And basically candles. Not even solar panels, and they were spending hours playing with three stones, and they're happy kids. So happiness and concentration are so intimate, they could play for an hour with three stones because of some happiness, and they play, and the playing with just three stones, they didn't need Fisher Price shop full of plastic toys or computers at that time, of course, but There's something there which is a child that is happy can play for hours. So the happiness does create concentration, and that's very basic. We know that. I went to a lot of Goenka retreats. I calculated 15 10-day retreats in the Goenka tradition in India and in England. And that's a lot of samadhi practice. But I wasn't that good at samadhi. I was actually more interested in insight. And being a kind of old hippie, kind of exploring the reality, the mystery, and I was an explorer, and the samadhi wasn't my thing that much, but insight was. But I was a good boy, so I just sat through 12 hours of meditation every day for 10 days, many times. I had a lot of passageways of insight, of discovery, of working with blocks, of working with the stuff that came up, working with pain and difficulty and dissolving that. And then years after that, and I really still don't consider myself a real samadhi, a deep samadhi practitioner. That means into really deep concentration, like yogis and the Eastern view of deep concentration, where you basically disappear. So it wasn't so much my thing. But then one day, someone told me, it was a Swiss teacher that came here and taught Mahasi practice, a very traditional practice, like Goenka in a way. And she said, a good test of samadhi is if you can count 500 breaths without missing one. Just sort of threw it out, like Mifchan Bagrut, you know. She just threw it out in conversation. Don't know where she got it from. So I said, oh, that's interesting, I'll try it. And I tried it, and I could do it. And I thought, how is that? That's amazing. I'm not a samadhi person, but I could count 500 breaths without missing one. So something's there. And I understood that the insight and the basic clearing or cleaning of obstacles, of hindrances, of attachments allowed the samadhi. Samadhi came because of some basic okayness and openness in the consciousness that wasn't tripped up, you could say in English, michsholim. It wasn't falling over and stuck. And then samadhi is actually easier. Very often, we need the happiness. We need, as equipment, the Buddha talked about joy as equipment for the journey. Well, that's a whole other way of looking at it. It's not a fruit of the practice. It is the equipment we need to put in the pocket when we go to practice. And one of the reasons we need this equipment of happiness or joy or okayness is because on the journey, we meet a lot of unknowns. On the journey, we go beyond the ordinary conditioned mind, that the regular mind that says, I know this and I know that, and this is this and this is that, and this is me and this is the world, and this is Netanyahu and this is not, and this is... We go beyond the known. And if we don't go beyond the known, we can't really call it a spiritual journey. It can be a journey that makes us much, and it does, more contented and more okay and with ourselves and with life. But the spiritual side of it really needs us to touch the unknown, that we don't know what that is. And to go to places without fear. And that's where we really need some equipment. I remember in India, in one of my retreats, a long personal retreat, I experienced quite a bit of fear facing some huge leap that I needed to make into the unknown. It's very specific, and I just faced a lot of fear. Went to that edge, and I couldn't go further. And there was a teacher nearby. It was in an ashram. I was on my own. A teacher nearby, and I told him about this Indian guy, and he said, "Oh, the best way to jump into the unknown is your happiness. If you're happy and okay, you can jump to places that you can't even imagine without fear, because happiness is the other side of fear." So, okay. It didn't really work. But maybe it did, because I decided that the whole thing was a complete fabrication, an unnecessary project to jump anywhere. And I simply spent the last part of the retreat in a hammock, just enjoying myself. Nothing to do, nothing, nowhere to jump, no fear of anything, all bullshit. Yeah, you're just enjoying this moment. So maybe that is the happiness, I don't know. But I'm just saying, maybe it worked. But the opposite is also true, that what we're doing for concentration, call it concentration, I prefer the word samadhi because it's less structured. And samadhi has more gentleness in it because it does have this sense of persistence, but it also has, like I said, the translation of the Sanskrit samadhi is just gathering ourselves, gathering our attention. So, by the way, in brackets, if we are able to watch the last World Cup football, which I didn't see any of it, and I'm not interested, but I see some people I know were just, and including Christopher, for example, just really into it. If you can watch the ball in a football game for an hour, is it, 45 minutes each side? That's super samadhi. You're right there. You're not lost. You're right there following the ball. So the ball is moving, but it's not different from the breath. The breath is moving. It doesn't have to be only one thing, samadhi. It can be in life. Anyway, there's something about samadhi which helps us to be not disturbed. Because again and again, and we're doing it here, and all of us are doing it, we may have judgments about our practice. Oh, it's not really happening, or it is happening, it's not happening. But I can tell you it is happening. I've not met one of you in any of the groups or one-to-ones that hasn't been developing samadhi in this retreat. The fact that you can sit 45 minutes quietly, never mind if the mind is jumping off into your, like I say, back off to Kfar Saba or what you have to do next week, doesn't matter. There's a there-ness, a here-ness, a presence there still in this 45 minutes. That's good enough. Some more, some less, but we don't need to kind of make samadhi too exotic. So samadhi will help, though, to take us out of our story and make our story less dominant, slowly, slowly. And it brings us in again and again into the present moment. And and it helps us to use the senses mostly in the meditation we're doing here, we're using the sense of touch. So touch is an internal sense. We touch the breath inside our body. But we sometimes touch outside, and we sometimes use hearing, we use senses. But the senses connect us to the world in the present moment, and that's what we're doing here. In other words, the senses themselves cut through the bullshit. Just the knowing, we cannot know anything except in the present moment. It's nothing. We cannot know what was, we cannot know what will be. So the senses are there always in the present moment, connecting us to the world. They're doorways. And there is a huge relief from our pain and our stories and our struggles. I remember meeting in India an Aborigine chief of an Aborigine tribe. And he was actually trained as a psychologist, and he had clients in Melbourne, in Australia. And he wrote a book, which I have, and I liked it. And he said, whenever I have clients that come with depression and anxiety and worry and concern, they come, tell me the story. But outside the window, there is this amazing Australian bird that sings an unbelievable song. And every time, that bird is the psychologist, not me. Because I tell my client, okay, I hear you, but do you hear the bird? And the client continues, no, well, you know, the difficulties and the struggle and everything. Wait, do you hear the bird? And the client will go on, yeah, but okay, but I've got to tell you this, I've got to tell you that. Do you hear the bird? And then many times he said, oh, isn't that beautiful? The client would say. And then he would say, well, let's listen together to the music of this bird. And the two of them would sit quietly for 5 minutes. And very often, this psychologist would then come back and say, so what was it you're saying? Oh, it doesn't matter anymore. It's not so important. So there's this connecting to the senses in a very basic way is really where what we're doing here. By the way, I wrote an article about this guy, and it came out in Chaim Acherim many, many years ago. I don't know if many years ago. And I have the article. And, this is actually, in another language or another description of exactly what Yonatan was saying before about intimacy. The senses connect us to the world, and there is intimacy. They are joining us to the world. That is intimacy. The world can be the bird in Australia, it can be our body, it can be another person, it can be the eyes behind the eyes of a person we meet in the street. And we can add happiness to that. So right now I talked about how samadhi is helped by happiness, and we can add happiness to samadhi. And the example I want to give is a monk that I met in America a long time ago. He was more than 100, a Cambodian Buddhist monk. And he was giving some teachings. And I remember we were in a room with a few people, and someone said, what's your practice? Daily practice. He said, I go through my body with concentration, going through every bit of my body. And every bit of my body, I ask it, are you happy? Right ear, are you happy? Yes, I'm happy. Left ear, are you happy? Yes, I'm happy. Nose, are you happy? Yes. Lips, how are you? I'm happy. So he added in that way, added happiness to the practice, then jumped from being technical samadhi to something that already has in it the happiness as a power, as equipment for a samadhi. And it goes further and further. And I have to tell you a really strange story, funny story. Again, personal story. Very weird. One day, I had problems with my knee. And one day, I really hurt my knee. And I was sure that, you know, I needed a surgery. And I went to the clinic in Nahariya, Kupat Holim. And I went upstairs and there was a guy, huge guy, full of muscles. And he said, lie down. And I thought, oh my God, what's going to happen now? My knee couldn't be straightened. It was bent totally. I couldn't walk on it. And he lay me down and he just went, duck, like this. And it was like so scary. And he was big muscly guy from Georgia, Gruzini. And he said, you'll need surgery. Go, your meniscus is torn. He said, care about meniscus, you need surgery. So go, here's a petek, go. I hopped downstairs, out into the street, and promptly fainted on the pavement in the street of Nahariya. Out, totally. Out, unconscious. After a couple of minutes, I saw white light and such bliss. It was unbelievable bliss. Like the world was filled with white light. There was nothing else in the universe, just this total white light, which was so joyful, and I wanted it to last forever. I had no idea where I was. I had no sense of a body. I had no sense of anything other than this white light that was taking over everything. Slowly, 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 the white light got smaller and smaller, and I realized I was looking at the white wall of the building of the Kupat Cholim in Nahariya, and I was on the lying down on the midrachov on the pavement and looking at the white wall. And I was so sad. It's gone. Oh my God. But I never forgot that ecstasy was really strong. And samadhi can, you know, take us to these places, and the joy and the bliss and the samadhi can be connected. And there is a whole teaching on the jhanas, called jhanas, which are similar to, if you've done yoga, you know something about dhyana. And dhyana is withdrawing of the senses, concentration, and jhana is the language, the Pali language for that. And the states of concentration that are marked by joy and bliss. And what's interesting is that as you go through the jhanas, these states of concentration that are quite well defined, the joy gets more subtle and balanced and becomes what we're talking about here, a deeper happiness, which is just, you could say, contentment, svyutratson. As you go through states of concentration, the joy becomes less crude or rough or agitate high, but it becomes much quieter and becomes just basic contentment. And it's the insight that does that. It's not the intensivity of state of a super powerful samadhi practice. It's insight. It's a clarity on things that we can let go of. It's letting go gradually allows more samadhi, allows more concentration. And any of you interested, Karen Arbel wrote a lovely book just on this issue of how insight can help with concentration. We normally, again, think of the reverse, that concentration is needed in order to open insight and clarity. It's true, but the opposite is also true, that if we let go of obstacles and issues and disturbances and struggles, internal struggles, the mind gets quieter and concentration happens because of that, just like I said about happiness. So that tells us, and here is where I really want to kind of bring your attention to that the Dharma is a big story and is not just a technique I need to go and learn. Because it's clear that all these processes are non-linear. They are not, there isn't a law of cause and effect. Sibatiyut. If I do this, then. If I do one retreat, I get this. If I get two retreats, I get that. And three retreats, I get that. Four retreats, I get that. It's not like that. And mind you, you know, people sometimes come after many retreats with big complaints. I've been doing 10 retreats and this, and I'm still angry at my partner. How is that possible? You've been 40, 50 years in this body, and you think you can cancel anger from 10 retreats with Tovana or somewhere else? 40 years we've been in the body. This is primal stuff, anger. You think you can get rid of it because you've done a retreat, you've got V, this retreat, this retreat, this retreat, done the V. So it's a cycle, it's cyclical. The happiness brings samadhi, samadhi brings happiness. Insight cleans the system to allow more concentration and inner peace. Inner peace is needed in order to clean the system of conditioned reactions. Senses are open, but the joy comes, you know, the eros comes through the senses, but then that feeds back and in a way cleans the mind. So the whole thing is cyclical, and so it takes us to another place which is much softer and non-linear and not so Western. Because the Western mind is very linear. It says, if I do that, then I should get that. That's not really the Eastern way. The Eastern is much more holistic. And it's in the word attachment that you heard about yesterday from Yonatan. Because attachment, the second noble truth, is often seen as something I need to work to get rid of or to undo so that I can experience the freedom of non-attachment. But there is the translation of upadana, which is, we translate as attachment, is actually feeding. It's what we feed that's much more gentle process. It's what we feed and what we don't feed. So it comes from a very kind of ancient tradition that our suffering is like a fire and our attachment is like a fire. And if we don't give it fuel, it will go by itself. It will quieten by itself. And we instead give fuel. We feed what is healthy for us, such as our happiness. And that's a very different way. And it also explains, some of you are saying, well, what's the practice? What do I have to practice now? But if we see, what is it that we feed? in us. And what is it that we don't feed? It's a much more kind of holistic way of looking at things. And that's right in the heart of the language of the Four Noble Truths. So it's a holistic framework, this practice. I won't go into it. The Paticchasamuppada is the way it's clarified in its hugely important and beautiful teaching, and I have an online course on it if you're interested. But there are 12 steps, but none of them are linear. The map isn't 12 steps one after another. You can cut across any of them. Yes, it can be 12 steps one after another, but you can jump backwards, forwards, up, down, cross, and they go backwards and they go forwards. And I won't go into them now, otherwise you complain. needs a whole course itself. But it's very interesting that what we feed, that now we understand, for example, how we're learning here another way of life in this retreat. And it's as important as our samadhi. A way of, with ethics, a way of being with each other, a way of being with ourselves, a sense of a little bit letting go of unnecessary stuff. That's just as important. So there's a holistic framework to this, which I think is just good that you know. It doesn't mean to say you shouldn't really work on the practice, but it gives it a sort of a bigger sense of what we're doing here. I like the, I used to go and sit every Yom Kippur in Klil, and I used to go to the Tefillah and just meditate in the corner the whole day. Couldn't bear the prayer book, the Machzor, too many words, too much for me. But one sentence I really loved, and I usually would come on Kol Nidre and just get this one sentence, Mishpat Echad, and more or less that was it. And it was Or Zaru La Tzadik V'Yishrei Lev Simcha. And it's very relevant to us. Yishrei Lev Simcha. Where we direct our heart is joy. To direct our heart to the right place is a source of joy. And it's just such a lovely message. And the joy comes from directing or feeding. So for those of you that are interested, this is all in the basic instructions that the Vipassana and mindfulness movement is based on, which is the Satipatthana Sutta, and of course many, many other suttas, but that's a key sutta. And what's interesting is we actually very lightly have been following that. The first base is Kaya Upasana, which is the body. Second one is Vedana Upasana, which is oil and joy. The third one is Chitta Upasana, which is mind, heart, thought. And the fourth is Dharma. So it's mindfulness of Dharma. And that's what I'm talking about tonight. Because it's the fourth foundation, meaning the fourth place that we need to put our attention to in our practice. So it's body, Vedana, mind, heart, and the teachings. So the Four Noble Truths are the teachings. They're there in the Dharma, in the fourth foundation. understanding what is attachment and non-attachment as an experience of what am I feeding now, that's the fourth. So why I'm saying this is that sometimes, you know, you could think, well, it's all kind of spiritual stuff and what I really need is just the practice of the first three, body, pain, joy, and mind, how to deal with all of that. But the fourth is right there in the original text of what we're trying to do here. So we do need that. So we do need to know, what am I feeding, for example, in the Four Noble Truths, and experience that, not as a theory and not as a Buddhist teaching or a concept, but actual experience in the present moment. What am I feeding now? It's a very powerful question and experience in the present moment, which is right there in the original instruction of the Satipatthana Sutta. The hindrances are there. Didn't talk much about that, and I don't want to talk much about that now, but, you know, they're there as some of the mind-body pains we're going through. Restlessness and tiredness and so on. They're there as teachings. In other words, not as problems that stop meditation, but teachings of insight that help our concentration if we know to work with them, to let them go. Restlessness, for example, agitation. We don't see it. I can't meditate because I'm agitated. I'm isheket, I'm restless. My mind is all over the place. My body is restless. No, that is the meditation. There is where you go. What is the experience of restlessness? Can I love this restlessness, look at it, allow it, meet it, explore it, be kind to it, and let it go? So working with these things is the practice. They're not obstacles to practice. They are the practice. So that's in the fourth foundation. And one thing that I do want to mention in this context is the factors of awakening. That's also there in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And the factors of the awakening, you could call it the engines that drive our awakening. What are the engines? What's powering our awakening? What are the qualities that we feed? They're not experiences. They're more like states of mind that we develop, that we feed through the practice, that then grow and stay with us our whole life, and that they kind of encourage us to be a bigger person, less conditioned, less imprisoned by conditioning, hatnaya. So they too are a list. There's lots of lists in the teachings, but again, they're not linear. But I'll just very quickly go through them, just so that you know what they are, because one of them is joy. And so the first is mindfulness, which is what we're doing. And mindfulness, don't forget, is direct seeing. Mindfulness is not rumination, chafira. It's seeing directly. We see without any intermediary. It's, again, the senses that connect us to what's happening now in this moment. The intimacy. If we practice mindfulness, we can begin to go to the second stage, which is investigation or exploration or going deeper or go under the surface, touching things that are deeper, that are more subtle, listening to voices that we don't normally hear, and allowing insights to arise. And it's for example, hindrances that I mentioned, that's the investigation is where we work with restlessness. We investigate what it is really, and does it, what am I feeding? Am I feeding restlessness or not? How do I work with it? How? So this is going under the surface. The third is energy, which includes motivation, it includes faith, it includes sometimes determination, sometimes we feel we're struggling, we're really forcing ourselves, and sometimes we feel we're just flying like a bird on the wind, like a net, like a hawk flying without effort on the breeze in our practice. All of that is different states of energy, but it comes in a way because we go deeper. The Buddha said, how do you cross the flood of samsara? By not struggling and not stopping. And if you struggle, you get swept away. And if you stop, you sink. So not struggling and not stopping. So it's in between place, which is quite a good way of describing the right effort. And the fourth one is joy. And the joy then becomes, in a way, the result of all of those first three: awareness, going deeper, going understanding, dropping stuff that we don't need, seeing the way our motivation changes, our energy changes, now this, now that, now we're flying, now we're struggling. And the joy, like I was saying, leads to peace and calm, and from there goes to concentration and samadhi. And after that is equanimity, is a deep sense of just steadiness in life. But as I say, it's not a sequence. It goes backwards, forwards. It's not linear. So I want to explore just briefly we often think that our happiness or our joy comes from getting what we want, or not missing things, not lacking, especially in the Western world. But the teaching tells us that our happiness or our joy comes much more from the truth, from meeting the truth, not from having what we want. So we may have difficult times. We may and we will have sickness, aging and death. No way we can stop that. It's going to happen. So we better get ready. Don't wait too long. And the way to get ready is to understand that the truth of things is where we can feel joy even in the middle of it, sickness, aging and death. What do I mean by that? So I'll give you an example from... We used to teach retreats for people who are sick, who are in pain or have cancer. And we used to teach every year. And I remember we were a little bit cautious about should we have that, and they were taught with groups. So meditation practice, personal practice, and then group work together, dialogue, discussion between people there. And we were a bit unsure, should we have a group on death and dying? Isn't it too hard for people to who are sick and to have to have a group and discussing death and dying? We thought we'll just take have the courage and let's go for it. And so we did, not at the beginning of the retreat, but towards the end. That was always the group with the most laughter, the most tzchokim, the jokes, everyone laughing and joking, oh, you think this, oh, you know what they told me, oh, you know what the doctor said, oh, they're such idiots, you can't believe what they told me, oh, you know, etc., etc. They were laughing at themselves, laughing at each other. They were so happy to talk about death because it's so much more difficult to deny. Pain and suffering and dukkha comes from denial, comes from burying things, comes from escaping from things. But to meet the truth face to face, you meet the demon straight in the eyes and you realize she's a princess, but you never could see her like that. But the truth, you go under the surface of what things appear to be, the demon that is troubling me, you go under the surface through the factors of awakening, insight, mindfulness, looking, energy, motivation, all these things. You go under and you realize the truth brings joy, even if our experience is real difficult. There's a sutta about Buddha was walking in the forest and all of a sudden he heard sort of hysterical laughter coming from somewhere inside the forest. And he asked his monks, maybe you go and see who it is in laughing like crazy like that. So they went off and they came back to him and said, there is a monk sitting under a tree giggling and laughing all the time. And so we asked him, why are you so happy? How is it you're laughing like that? And the monk said, you don't know me, but I used to be a king. And I had a whole kingdom. But I never slept one full night because I had to have guards around my bed, because at any minute people would come and kill me in order to take my treasure and steal the kingdom, including my family. And I was non-stop anxious. I had tons of money. Anxious billionaire, milliard. One day I left the whole thing behind. I walked out of my palace. I put on the robes of a monk. I came to the forest, I sat under a tree, and now I'm so happy, and the bottom line is a nice one. I'm so happy because my mind is wandering like a deer grazing in the forest. It's such a beautiful image. My mind is like a deer, ayal, is just grazing in the forest. And so the happiness comes from seeing the truth of things, the truth of our conditioning of what makes us unhappy, the truth of how we make this world where we think is attacking us, giving us a hard time, full of struggle. But our relationship to this world is up to us. What we make, we can unmake. If we see that our conditioning makes our suffering, we can undo that, and we can feed the unconditioned. But we have to see the truth of it first. There is a teaching that I love that says this so well, and it's the Tibetan Dzogchen teaching, and it's a really it's challenging because the Dzogchen teaching says there is one reality, which is, it's called the natural great perfection, meaning everything is perfect, cannot be imperfect. The way we look at it can be imperfect. But a little bit like in the Tanakh, when God made the world and said, it's good. Are we going to say it's not good? Are we cleverer than God? Somehow, we know it's not good, but God says it's good. So I'm joking a little bit, but the natural great perfection is a very deep statement of reality, which is that the perfection is there, but we may not see it. We interpret it as imperfect. But that's our meeting with it. The way we see it, the way we meet on the seam, the tefer between us and the world, that's where the dukkha is. But who can say the world is wrong? Is a mistake? Cannot. So the natural great perfection is practice that works with this. And it's a very powerful Tibetan practice. It works with the natural perfection rather than working with the conditioned mind. It works with the perfection itself. So final word, liberation, nirvana, realization is not feeding the fire anymore, not feeding the fire of neediness, aversion, wanting, not wanting, struggling, wanting to change, wanting to fix, wanting to control, wanting to get rid of, wanting to get, etc. It's not feeding that. The fire goes out. And the joy we experience in realization is a sign of the fire going out. So nirvana is not a state of joy, but joy is a sign of liberation. Joy and deep happiness is a sign that of realization, of liberation happening. And because of that, as my very first teacher, I think, was Alan Watts, long time ago, and not live, I never saw him live, but I saw him, I read his books. And there's a line in one of his books that I just stay with me 50 years. He says, you will not get a miserable sage, tzaddik, or wise person. The wise person is always going to be joyful, cheerful, he said. Enduring cheerfulness, kind of non-stop cheerfulness, was the mark of a wise or a liberated person. And it stayed with me for these 50 years. It's really amazing. By the way, you can all look him up. There's many YouTubes now of Alan Watts that appear, I noticed. And he's a very eloquent speaker. You might like to look him up. But he's like from 50 years ago. Okay, thank you. Let's take a minute of quiet. So we'll take half an hour for walking with the bell ringer. Pay attention to the fact we're a little bit late, so we take a full half an hour for walking. And when you come back, we can arrange the room to lie down. Okay, so you can sort it out, to sort yourselves out. It does work, even with this many people. We've done it. So it'll work out.